So we are thrilled to get to be a part of Greenbelt 14. The last time Thistle Farms was invited to be here was in 2012, and we did not know to bring rain shoes. So we were in a tent like this, and the waters came in. It flooded that whole weekend, and everybody dispersed, and we walked out. We just took our shoes off and just walked out in the mud and muck. Were some of you guys here in 2012? Do you remember that? It was crazy. So to have a whole group here to get to talk to and share this story, thank you for coming in. If you have more questions about what we're going to talk about in the next little bit, you can talk to Charmaine Host, who is a friend of mine, an Episcopal priest here, who came to Nashville and stayed with us. This is Regina, who is a graduate of Magdalen, the outreach director, has probably helped 150, 200 women, I don't know how many, come in and be a part of the journey. This is Sheila McLean, who is also a graduate and has recently just earned her BA in psychology, and she does the work of Magdalen on the inside to take these ideas of community on the inside with women, and they are happy to answer questions. Levi, thank you so much. Marcus, thank you so much. Josh, thank you so much for starting it off. I said to them, the one thing that we have as a speakers group that no other group has here is a band to back us up. So I was hoping that when I made really good points during this talk, they would just strum along behind me. I didn't know y'all were going to break down. So what we're going to talk about tonight for a little bit is how to birth a new idea. What does it take to go from thinking a thought? I have a thought about the injustices in the world, and I have a sense of inspiration and something I want to do to react and turn that into reality. And so what I want to do is really think about it in terms of farming, to think about from the moment of seeing a field and the potential to reaping the harvest for all of us. Now, all of us know that the beginning of such thoughts we call inspiration. And they're like muses that pass us by, and they do not hang out for long. You may be able to catch the tail of one if you delay, but mostly you can't even remember the thought. I know from my life with my husband as a songwriter for the last 25 years that there are many times in the night when you might get an idea, and that idea is long gone by the morning, right? And that's how most of our thoughts are. We get a sense, or we get this insight, and we get this idea, this is something I would really love to do. You lose energy around it. You lose the original thought. You realize how crazy it is to think something can be different in this world. And so most of our thoughts, if you think about it, are like a breath that dissipates into the larger air that takes no root and has no place. But every now and then, one of our thoughts somehow takes space in us and begins to occupy some of our minds. And we start thinking about it more and more from different angles, and we start adding things to it. And a few of those thoughts even begin to take root in our hearts. So those are the thoughts that we're thinking about tonight. Those thoughts that you've had, those inspirational, beautiful thoughts that somehow have taken root in you and that you want to see grow into something. So in our journey of Magdalen and Thistle Farms, that's what happened. I started working with women who were coming off the streets into programs, and I hated them all. It just felt like there wasn't a lot of dignity in it, or that there was a warehousing of women, or that they were still with men who seemed to be able to maybe take some advantage of the low place that the women held for themselves in this world. And I started thinking about the idea of what sanctuary would really be like, and what would it look like for women to come off the streets? So the first way that I know that seeds take root are to start off very small and to have a small idea. So after a couple years of working and doing very, very small steps, we opened one house. And we were really clear in our mission. It was 2 years free Women could come and stay for 2 years free, and there would be no authority in the house. And so what happened was we opened up one house. I knew I didn't want to take any governmental state funding. I wanted all of it to be a gift. I wanted my time to be a gift to the people I served. And we simply invited five women to come off the streets or out of prison who had criminal histories of trafficking, addiction, and prostitution, and to come live together and to see how love can change the world. So one of the first of the five women that came was Regina. And Regina came, and she basically changed my life 17 years ago. What happened was is that when we started, the idea was, look at all these people it's going to take to help five women. That was how my mind was working in this outreach model that I had of the church. And so one night after about 3 weeks of opening the house, I drove by to make sure everybody was safe, and I drove by and I saw Regina dancing in a window. Now, Regina, like most of the Magdalene women who have come off the streets or are part of the Thistle Farms community, have reported much trauma, rape, abuse, all kinds of things on the street. Regina was so beat up when she came, she still had a boot on her leg, like a cast. And when I drove by and saw her dancing in the window, I was like, what is that? This is a recovery community. Why would anybody in God's name be dancing or having fun? So I went inside, and there she was by herself, dancing to some gospel music, and we laughed and we talked. She reminded me that you can have a Holy Ghost party. And I went out to my car and I wept. And I wept for all kinds of things, for all the injustices, for all this work ahead. But mostly it was because I couldn't remember the last time the Spirit had moved me in that way. And I knew that I needed this, and I needed this idea in this sense that the possibility of sanctuary and healing and love could be possible. So I wanted Regina to spend just a few minutes to talk about just what that recovery community looks like and what that idea has blossomed in her just for the next few minutes. Regina Mullins.
I got to move around. Can y'all hear me? Take it off. Okay, Becca. As she said, I'm Regina Mullins, and I want to talk about what that idea that she birthed did for me, how it changed my life. For so many years, I was on the streets in Nashville, Tennessee. Lost my children, lost homes, lost myself. And I stayed on those streets for a little over 20 years, in and out of crack houses, in and out of the prison system, living on the streets as a prostitute, thinking that there was no way out, thinking of all the reasons that I stayed out there, didn't have any hope. So I started to believe a lie. That most of us believe that I was going to die on the streets in Nashville. Either I was going to take a hit of crack and it was going to blow my heart up, or either I was going to get in a car with a John or a Trick and he was going to take me off somewhere and just kill me and that's going to be the end of me. Until last time in 1996 when I went to prison, and I was so happy to go to prison. Because I was tired. I was tired of the lifestyle. I was tired of the dope. I was tired of tricking. I was tired of not being able to go and hug my children, embrace my boys, be a daughter to my parents, be a sister to my siblings, be a friend to real friends that I've met along the way. And so in 1996, I went to prison, and I started searching for God in my life, because I always knew about God. So I started searching for that relationship And I was led to a program called Chances. And by the way, that was my last chance. I believe that was my last chance going into that program. And when I went into that program, I started learning a lot about me, and I started learning a whole lot about God forgiving me and that I was worthy to have a life. I just didn't know how I was going to get it. And in 1997, I made parole. I went up for parole, and I made parole. And that scared me to death because, like I said, I've been on the streets for a little bit over 20 years, and I was afraid of coming back outside. I was scared, afraid of me. I was afraid of going back into the same neighborhood, starting the same old cycle over and over again. And so a lady that I was incarcerated with told me about this program, this new idea. There was nothing for the prostitute or the woman on the streets that wanted to turn her life around. And she told me about this place called Magdalene House, and all of the prostitutes were there. And so at first I was like, I'm not trying to prostitute anymore. But the more she talked, I was like, hey, this might sound like something that can help me, you know. And the fact that it was ran by a priest, I really didn't want to go. I was like, I'm not ready to be in confession every day. I'm not ready to say 5,000 Hail Marys or 20 Abba Fathers or any of that, because I was the worst sinner that I thought I, you know, anybody knew. But anyway, this idea of women like myself coming from the street and being able to live together and the gift of not paying any rent, to me, that was a trick into the lifestyle, back into the lifestyle. I was like, nobody's doing that for anybody, nobody that I knew. It's like wherever you go, you've got to give something. So who's going to allow women like myself to come and live for free and 2 years for free? Who's doing that? Well, the Reverend Becca Stephen, who was a priest without a black shirt and a white collar, she was doing that. So I got out and I went to this place, this beautiful place that reminded me of home long ago. And when I walked into this place, it had a bed. I just come from a prison bed, a wrought iron bed with not mattresses. It was hard plastic, hard vinyl. Not a room with walls and pictures, but bars and concrete walls. Not a door that I could walk in and out of with a key. I got a key. I got my very own key to come in and go as I please. I just come from a prison cell that the guard said, lockdown. It's time to go to chow. It's time to go to Rick. It's time to take showers. It's time to go to the game room, whatever. I was not allowed to do anything unless they told me to do it. But here was a woman that opened up a home, not a house, but a home to me, and told me all she wanted me to do was sit down, decide what I wanted to do with my life, because I had a life to live, and that she would walk with me and help me reclaim my life. Well, I was still kind of skeptical, because who does that? Who does that? So I came into this program, and I was able to sit down for a minute in sanctuary, real sanctuary, and think about everything that I had just come from, the past, and where I wanted to go, and everything that I wanted to do, which was get a real job, not have to turn a trick again, not have to put another piece of dope in my body. I could hold down a real job. I could go back to school. I could be a mother again. And she allowed me to come in and make that plan to go and do that. And in the process, I got a bright idea. I'm like, there's so many women, Becca, that are still on the street that want out, but they felt like I felt there was no way out. So we got to do something. And so we started going back to the streets to talk to the women, just like myself, to letting them know that God does forgive, we forgive, you can forgive yourself, that you do have a life to live, and we're going to walk with you like she and so many others walked with me, and we're going to reclaim our lives, and we're going to take this thing, and we're going to just spread it all around Nashville and everywhere else we could spread it. And that's what we've done from back in 97 to today. And like she said, so many women have come behind because we've went back where they are. You know, the idea is to touch people where they are. And not just women like us, but the whole world. Because so many people are broken. So many people don't know how to get out of places that they feel like there's no way out of. So our job, our ideas, our mission is to go and touch, to love people where they are. One of our mottos is that love heals. And guess what? It does. It does. So we go and plant the seeds. Is that time up? We go and plant the seeds. And then we gather our people that's come along the way to go back and harvest. I think that's time up. Thank y'all.
Always. So for us, what happened is, and I think that a good model for all of us is when you have a small idea, you're beginning to nurture it, and how do you nurture it, and how do you make sure it can sprout? Once the seeds are planted, once Regina gets an idea of what outreach looks like, once I get an idea of a housing program, once you get an idea, once we got the idea of social enterprise, how do you sprout that? How does it really start to grow? And I think for me, it has taken three things. The first one is community. The very first thing is to get people to buy into the idea. That it can't be your idea. It can't be my seed. It is a seed that is planted in a communal ground of dirt to see if something can grow. So we can't take it as our idea. It's not like social enterprise in any other way where it's like, that's the visionary, that's the person, that's what you have to have it have. It has to be in a community. I learned that early on in Magdalene. So after we started Magdalene, we realized the women were still so poor, even after they were getting recovery, even after they were doing this great work, we started Thistle Farms, which is the social enterprise that supports Magdalene. We now have about 70 women employed. We are in about 400 stores. We are this close to being in Greenbelt. Our stuff is in customs, and we can't sell it. Is that so sad? We shipped it all, paid for it all, sent it all over here, and we cannot sell it yet. But we're still praying. Amen. Just need an amen on that. So growing it, getting it going. So when we started Thistle Farms, I had the brilliant idea of naming all the bath and body care products after biblical characters. That was my idea. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it. So I said, instead of just having bath salts, we'll just call it Lot's Wife. We have, Marcus is my third son, is named Moses, and we had a whole body care line called Moses Lip Balm, No More Desert Lips. We had all these products. I thought they were brilliant. I thought they were going to do really well. And I'm like, we are going to make millions off this. I have a great idea. So a marketing company came in after the first year when we'd sold about $10,000 worth of products total and said, okay, the first thing you have to do is get rid of all those horrible names. You cannot expect anybody to get it. They can't get, there's a house called Magdalene. They have a social enterprise called Thistle Farms run by the women who are residents of Magdalene. They make bath salts and it's called Lot's Wife, which is a reference, da da da. No one gets that. So just take all that off. And if I had been in a place, I think, where I was like, well, that was my vision. That was my idea. It never would have grown. But the idea that it's a communal vision means that everybody gets to use their expertise. Everybody gets to come in, and the good seed grows. And the bad seeds or the bad ideas can be laid aside, and it's nobody's ego. You don't have to worry about it. There's an old saying, if it has legs, it will walk. If it's good seeds, it will grow and produce a crop. And we have to be a part of that together. I think there has been a lot of emphasis on people, especially mission-minded people doing great work everywhere, that you have to be a visionary. You have to have the vision of it. You have to know what you're doing. And I think it's way too much emphasis. If you look at even the old Bible stories, if Paul got a great idea, he brought it back to the community. And it was in the community that ideas surprised everyone and something came up that no one could have recognized as their own. It was in the discussion in the community growing. One of our latest ventures was opening a whole cafe, a beautiful thistle stop cafe with a story in every cup. And it's the best example of, we had about maybe $150,000 to build a cafe, which is nothing, you know that. And in all this social justice work, one of the main things is that resources are so scarce and the dreams are so big. And the only way to bridge that gap is a communal vision and a communal buy-in. So what happened at the cafe is there ended up being a guy that was a designer, and he worked with teacups and driftwood. And he said, I can help you make this vision of a story in every cup come true. There was a group of men in prison that could build all the countertops that wanted to be a part of the healing of the women. There were people who had tables, who had things that they could bring in. They had machines donated from another group of coffee roasters in Nashville. And all these people started coming together, and this piece and this piece and this piece. And when you walk in, it is stunning. And it's no one's idea. It's not that you make decisions by committee. It's that when you have an idea, and you have an idea, and you have an idea, you have to trust the Spirit is working so that you can come together and those ideas can grow something new, unrecognizable and unimaginable by any one individual. That's how I think the best social enterprises start. So it's communal vision, communal buy-in. It is not simply ownership of the entrepreneur. The other thing, though, is it's not that you have to have a clear vision of the future. I think you have to have a realistic view of your past and the brokenness of your own past and the sight of love that you are willing to encounter whatever comes around the bend. But the other thing that really grows seeds of inspiration into social enterprises and social action is to be able to have the freedom to speak your hope. To have that kind of freedom in your life. If you are in a community of worship or a community that is coming together and you are not free to speak your hope, it is not a good place to grow those seeds. Even if you're wrong or even if it's crazy, one of the things I value most, and this is the truth of everything we have done at Magdalene and Thistle Farms, we have a circle. And you are allowed to speak in that circle. We light a candle that the women in the candle department have made to remember the women coming off the streets. And we get to speak our truth. And we get to speak it even if our voice shakes and we're not so sure about it. So if I have an idea, like we do need to start a shared trade federation or alliance. We do need to start a Thistle Stop Cafe. We do need to have a global impact more and more. I get to speak it. I can speak big dreams. It is one of the greatest inheritance we have been given, is the freedom to speak that kind of truth. And the bigger our dreams, the bigger the reality of a communal vision becomes. If we can speak something pretty big, even as we start very small, it happens. So after it's sprouting and after it's growing, there is this thing that happens so many times with new ideas that kill them, and it's called the tending of the plants. Sometimes the most boring part of the farming, right? Like, I have this idea for a song. I have an idea for a book. I have an idea for this place of justice in my life. Now I have to do the daily tasks of tending it, and it gets very, very old. And not always what I have learned in these last 20 years, not always the people that help spark ideas are the same people that need to tend those ideas. And we need to be free to move in and out of that in community too. That if there are some people who are very good tenders, who can follow through and do that daily tasks, they need to be given the freedom to do that, and other people might need to step back a little. People who are really fun on the front end and really energetic might be really slack asses on the tending. Is that right? Thank you. I mean, it's been so, every time we've started something, it's like there's a transition in the group, in the community that happens, and that is very natural, and we do not need to be afraid of it. We just need to invigorate the people who are good sprouters and then really nurture the people who are good tenders and have those folks doing what they are given their life's work to do. So the other thing is that for us at Thistle Farms and in most social enterprises and social justice movements, and I don't use the word movement lightly. I'm not saying movement like buy a t-shirt online. I'm saying movement where it's costing you something, in a movement that is growing over time and asks people to really give something of themselves. In order to grow a movement, you have to continually grow the enterprise. It is like a plant. It can't just be, that field looks good, let's stop growing it. That's called death. In this work, if it's not a movement, if it is not growing, it dies. And I didn't know that when we started out, and I don't necessarily think you want to know that when you start out. When we started out with one house and five women, it's like, this is beautiful and sweet. We are in love. It is a gift. And then there's another house, and then another house, then another house, then another house, then social enterprises, then community groups around the U.S., then partnerships abroad. Then there's a cafe, and then there's an alliance of movements, and it keeps growing, and that's the way it should be. That's how the seeds live and thrive, is it has to keep coming. The other thing about really growing and tending these crops, and if you are in any way doing this work, you will say amen to this. The number one thing people ask you is it self-sustaining? I hate that question. And if you've done this work, you may hate that question too. Is that self-sustaining? Is your social enterprise self-sustaining? Is your ministry self-sustaining? And it's like, what crop really of people or plants are self-sustaining? It takes rain. It takes tending. It takes love. And that notion that any of us think we may ever be self-sustaining is crazy. So our social enterprise this year, for the first time, we are 14 years old, for the first time grossed over $1 million US in sales this year. It took another $1 million in donations to sustain the whole enterprise of what we're trying to do. But that means growing new seeds, going inside the prison to keep giving and to keep doing. It was never our intention to start out that we are going to make enough candles to help women all over the globe. Our intention is that we pay women living and sustainable wages and employ people with meaningful work and to be able to do their ministry and equip themselves and buy homes and go out and preach how love heals and continue to feed the good rich soil that we have with outside resources so that field can triple and quadruple in a year. Does that make sense? So I think it's a misnomer, and what happens is we become such good farmers as we tend it that we have something to say to the larger world, that we have something to say about how justice is done and what self-sustaining looks like, because what we are trying to sustain is not that one crop, not that one group of women, but a whole community of people that leave no one behind, that don't give up on hope. That's what we're trying to sustain. So we'll put good resources into that crop so it can happen. The beautiful part of this work and the beautiful part of really what we're seeing at Greenbelt is everybody's coming together. And I cannot wait to get to know everybody so much better over these 4 days and hear about all the great work you guys are doing and how we can be a part of it is the harvest. When you see a crop of people who have been out growing and tending their fields and then watching it come together and see the ability of a harvest, it is stunning. But I think what happens sometimes for all of us is sometimes we get confused and we think the harvest is ours. And it was never ours to begin with. It wasn't our soil. We didn't make it. It wasn't our seeds. We didn't make it. We got to watch it grow. But sometimes I think especially because resources become so scarce in social justice enterprises that people think the harvest is theirs and they become protective. And I think it kills future crops. Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about the idea that there's an old saying that says, the smaller the pie, the bigger fight over the piece. Have you heard that one? So in this work, while we're doing this, it's like, okay, so our idea is Magdalene. This is our model. So you can't have it. Our issue is women and trafficking. Your issue may be sexual violence and domestic violence, different issue. And people start making these lines and thinking this is their part of the harvest instead of sharing it all. And so what we've been consciously doing at Magdalene and Thistle Farms is to say we are amazed by the harvest and we want to share it and we want to have no boundaries. It is our pie together. And I'm saying pie, P-I-E. I know it's hard to understand my southern accent. But our effort at that has been this thing called shared trade that we started this year. So you go from one house in 1997 to a social enterprise, to communities around the U.S., to partnerships globally. And so this year we've really launched this new effort of why can't all these groups just be an alliance? We can be independent groups. We can have our own boards. We can raise our own money. We can be our own not-for-profit status. But we need to be an alliance and share so that women can have a greater and greater portion of the benefits of this harvest, not the individual organizations, but the women who are the producers who continually pay the highest price in the value chain and get lesser and lesser of the share. So I don't know how many of you know Abby. She is here for the next 4 days too. Abby Hewitt, which is why we're here, and we love you dearly. And she is the project manager for this. And so it's really inviting a lot of groups to come together and say, we are going to have economic leverage. We are going to make a difference. We are going to see a harvest like we have never seen. We have 14 partners that have come together, and we're very, very interested in having new partners come along and be a part of that. There is not one issue. All the issues of injustice that we've seen with the women, they are universal, that are born on individual backs, but they're also tied into so many other issues. You know, our prison system in the U.S. is one of the most horrific systems globally. And the poverty and racism that feeds into that, and then the red carpet into those prisons from childhood trauma are connected as well. And so the women that we serve at Thistle Farms and Magdalene on average are first raped between the ages of 7 and 11 and on average hit the streets in their teenage years. And we get that all the issues that people have been interested in, we need to tie more and more closely with those issues so it's a communal healing and a communal harvest. So what I want to do is we are going to invite questions and comments, and if you want to just any of the thoughts that we have about what these ideas look like and how they're planted and how we give them space and how we tend them and grow them and then marvel at their beauty as they blossom, let's have a little bit of time to share some of that. Thank y'all very much.
Firstly, thank you very much. You are incredible collectively. What would you say to organizations similar to yourselves who have ideas and other members within their already established organizations are hesitant or skeptical that such enterprises can actually succeed, and the tension that that involves. How do you deal with that?
I've been through that. I've been through that where there's like, you're going to do what? You know, or there's hesitancy, especially on people who are really, financially responsible for the organization, namely like the board of directors. And to me, that's when it gets interesting. That's when it becomes a faith journey, and it's time to really wrestle with that. And sometimes they're right, people who say that doesn't seem like a good idea, and sometimes they're wrong. But I never want fear to be the basis for making that decision. And usually, if it is an inspired idea, which is what we were talking about tonight, there's a lot of energy around it. And if you can communicate that kind of energy in that kind of space where hope can have room, people will buy into it. I mean, one of the things I think I have learned over the 20 years has been that I used to hide the failures a little bit to myself or to other people because I thought then we'll all collapse or it will fall apart or people will know. You know, like if a woman relapsed, we have about 80% of the women who come into the program from 2005 to 2012, 82% of the women graduated in the program, which is an amazing statistic to have 2 years clean for that number of folks. But that meant there were 20%, one in five women were going out and having not just a relapse and coming back, but having horrible relapses, and we buried some women who had relapsed. And it was a fear of judgment that kept me from being really honest about that part of the work and thinking people then will say, you can't keep doing this. The issues are too bad. You really don't know what you're doing. We're throwing money away. People don't change. All those judgmental things that go on in your head. And over, when I have really been honest, not just about the amazing successes, but by the heartbreaking failures, I have learned and believe people want to hope with you. That if you're willing to do the work and really put your whole heart, mind, body, and spirit into it, people want to hope with you. And if you can convey that to whoever is working with you in that issue, whatever the next step is, if it's social enterprise or new housing initiatives, convey that hope in the midst of brutal honesty about how hard the issues are and about how hard the work is. I think people open up and join with you. Do you want to say anything on that?
Yeah, I did. I want to say something on it. One of the things that I learned coming through the program is that, we're going to fall. We all are going to fall. And then there's always those people that are saying, see, I told you so. See, I told you so. But one of the best things that helped, not just myself, was that somebody believed. Even if she was doubtful, she still believed, and she still kept pushing us to believe in ourselves. And then because we believed in ourselves and we knew that other people believed in us, then that made them more motivated to keep, grabbing the next piece of harvest, the next lady to come behind us, you know. And one of the things is that, like Becca was talking about, the brutal honesty, because a lot of times when, if a woman would relapse or if she fell down, she wouldn't want to come back because of the shame and guilt of being judged, you know. But one of the things that Becca always says is that there's always a way to find your way home. There's always a way back. And when they come back, if they've got enough of themselves to push the shame and guilt aside just for a little bit and then be embraced with love, that makes the hope all the more bigger and better.
One last thing is, if you're talking to a board and you're specifically talking about social enterprise, to remind them that dollar for dollar, if you sell a candle for $10, probably in grants back to the organization, you can triple that amount. That even if you're not making that, if they're scared of the social enterprise piece specifically, that it helps on donations even for the not-for-profit side of it. I just want to throw that out there. It's a good fundraising tool. Yeah.
Hi. I was really inspired by Regina saying that you helped her reclaim her life. And I was equally shocked when you said that a lot of the women you serve have been raped between 7 and 11 and they're on the streets in their teens. And I just want to ask, because your organization obviously helps women who have already been on the streets and are kind of damaged by that, what do you do, or what do you partner to prevent that happening, like these little girls being raped at that age and going on the streets at the teens? So rather than being like at the end of the cycle, something is being ploughed in to prevent this happening in the first place, a new generation of girls being abused and pimping or prostituting themselves.
Thank you. That question always comes up, and it's a beautiful, beautiful question. And the first thing I want to say is, in my mind over the years, it's not an either-or question, that the timeless and universal nature of sexual violence against women has humbled me and reminds me that, we're not here saying that we know any one answer to sexual abuse or sexual violence against women, and that we are part of a healing of a world that has been broken for longer than anybody can remember. But we're also part of a world that wants to keep people safe and keep our children safe. And one of the things we've done, and I think is a beautiful thing, is to link groups like ours who are working with women who are survivors, and working with groups who are in the preventative health care. So there's a coalition of safety, and I would love to give you some literature about it, but it's about, there's like 12 different organizations that are specifically targeted around children's health and safety that we have partnered with in a coalition in Nashville. And I love it because it's not saying like, it's not just, programs who intervene on the back end, but programs who are about coming into the school systems and about talking with people. The other thing that we've been doing too is learning that because it's generational, if you are about healing the women, the old adage, rape the women, kill the village, heal the women, heal the village, and that we go back generationally. So it may be that Regina comes into recovery, but it also may be her aunt, her cousin, maybe her uncle who sexually abused her. All these things that have been going on in her family can then come out into light, and generations are healed together. And I really do believe in both of those things, more coalitions and more intergenerational recovery. Go ahead.
And just to add to that, is that a lot of times there's no one for the little girl to talk to. And so one of the things that we've done as an organization is we've gone back to the streets to talk to the women, letting them know there's a way out. And we try to reach the young girl before she's an old woman on the streets, to let her know that she doesn't have to go take the journey that we've taken, but we can turn around right now and come together and build the hope. So it's like Becca said, the partnerships of, one heal another one. Each one heal one. Yeah.
Thank you. I think we have time for one or two.
And that little lady right here in front.
I work in a women's prison, and I'm really aware of the huge amount of sort of damage that women come to us with from their past lives and experiences. Do you think the sort of healing that you've talked about and experienced, is that largely a result of the living in community and the interaction with others? Or are you also getting in sort of therapeutic inputs like counseling or art therapy or whatever to help that healing process?
I mean, we are big believers that it's both. I mean, community is a healing entity that holds us up and holds us accountable. But every individual woman has, access to this rape and sexual abuse center, to their therapists, to their doctors. into all the healthcare systems and meds and everything, the holistic approach. So it's, I don't think it's one or the other. I think you're, I mean, I think in your question, you're exactly right. It's both. It is community and individual. Yeah. One more.
I visited your community in 2009, and it was a real inspiration. And we're just on, in the embryonic stages of forming a community at the moment. We have four people in on a farm, an organic farm. And yeah. What I really wanted to know was, you know, you say that in the houses you've got no authority. How does that work in practice? You know, what happens, how do you monitor if people relapse? I just want to know how you set your rules or, you know, how that's developed.
It's not authority that, it's not that there's not authority that lives in the house. No, it's like we come, we come together and we create the way we live in unison, in unity, and we respect what we say and how we're going to live together. So if that is broken, then we, as a community, hold each other accountable. Do you understand what I'm saying?
So if people are not working with the community, does that mean they move on? Or
they can, or they make a decision that they want to work with the community. If they decide that they don't want to do the Magdalene way, the community, what we set in place, mm-hmm. then we help them, you know, find somewhere, another program that may be better for them.
Okay, thanks.
I think the other thing is it takes time. I mean, trust takes time. And so, you know, you might have some great resources and still have to find your way through it to make decisions. You know, and for us, the whole thing is that if you have a history of sexual trauma, especially rape from a young age, authority is the worst trigger you can offer. It's why prison systems and all the judicial and punitive systems become just more violent to women. And so the idea of removing that from the equation of healing, we have found at least, is to remove one of the triggers for relapse. Thank you all so much.